Greetings, friends. This is a recording of the Truth of Happiness course, Week 7, Saturday class discussion and Q&A on developing the Eightfold Path as the supportive framework for Samatha Vipassana meditation in the context of the Four Noble Truths. This is a recording of our Sangha discussion on the interrelationship of Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. This was recorded in Frenchtown, New Jersey on January 30th, 2016. So, good morning, everyone. I think we're in week 8, but first I'd like to hear how your study of week 7 and Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha, what you've gotten out of that, and most importantly, how you see those three marks of existence in relation to the Four Noble Truths and how the Eightfold Path develops an understanding of those. So, let's start with Kevin.
Well, great to be here. Thanks for... So, I actually was just reading chapter 8, so you're making me go back, because I was developing an understanding of that. So, well, maybe I'll just, you know, talk about that. I was noticing key words that really stuck out to me. The concepts was dispassion, dispassionate observation. Really hitting me, and then, you know, noticing this concept of sort of the eye making, and then I guess if that builds upon the previous week's chapter, you know, the continual noticing where we continually cling and defend to, you know, the ego personality or where it would arise, and it's just the insight and understanding that keeps developing every day. I wouldn't have that without the consistency of the practice and that just, you know, refined awareness. And, it's just great to be experiencing it.
Yeah, it is. To really understand what's occurring. It brings a lot of meaning into our lives, doesn't it? And it all is within that framework. Dependent origination does point back to the three marks of existence. And it's what's occurring within those three discrete components that are linked together by our own conditioned thinking. Thank you for sharing that. So again, we're talking about integrating Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha into the practice that we're developing. And so how are you doing with that?
There's a lot of layers peeling back, so...
Yeah.
It's been good. I'm seeing it. Just starting to feel more comfortable when I'm realizing, when I'm noticing things, which is nice. I'm not as upset when I'm not reacting to noticing as much, so. And I think that has to do with just getting further into the practice.
Yeah, and developing that dispassion that Kevin mentioned. You know,
just becoming more objective.
Yeah.
And that actually helps me often when I'm feeling reactionary, is reminding myself that to try to be objective to what's happening.
Yeah, as you've developed that understanding, you see the, goes back to the week that we're talking about, to week 7, you realize the impermanence of all things, and as we developed an understanding of the impermanence of all things, we realize that nothing is personal, too, because it's impermanent. How can it be personal? Why take it personal? And that starts deepening that dispassionate look at the world. Thank you. Mark, good to see you.
Good to see you as well. Good to be here.
I see you have some questions.
Yeah, I had some questions. some thoughts, too, just in general. The chapter for week 7, a lot of things started to make sense as I read through it. Really enjoyed reading the chapter. one of the things that you had said in there was this concept of the perceiver, and that made a lot of sense to me. So... the way that I interpreted that was that have these thoughts, feelings, emotions, and perceptions that the consciousness attaches themselves to it in some way. And the way that I saw that was that that perceiver, that's creator, that ego personality that's created, I saw that as like a barrier between the ego and the outside world. And once that made sense to me, then what made sense was how if you are a perceiver and everything is outside of you, then as the world tries to come into your little ego area, you're defending your ego, right? Because things that are trying to come in are probably counter to what you believe you are, this I that I am.
A separate and discrete.
Right.
Yeah.
So that starts to make a lot of sense as to how, as an ego personality, you do take things personal. But then realizing that that's not real, that's not actually how the world is functioning, helped me immediately to understand, you know, why you should not take things personal.
Or how not to.
Yeah. It's both of those.
It is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's one thing to say, don't take it personally, but you also have to understand how to do it.
Right. And that's where the questions come in. But, but that just made a lot of sense all of a sudden. Okay. Understanding that it's not, that an ego is actually creating this boundary or this barrier in my mind. And then realizing that that's not real helped me to break it all down and let go of it. So that was one piece of insight that I had that I thought was pretty powerful. And then, as I kind of followed that through, one of the questions that I had was, the thing that I've struggled to understand, I guess, in the teachings is this difference between becoming a robot and having emotions. So, as I understood that abandoning an ego personality makes a lot of sense, and not taking personally makes a lot of sense because of the impermanence of all things and because there is no I or ego. Then I was trying to understand, how do you have thoughts or how do you have emotions if there's nothing to attach them to, right? And what I kind of came up with was, you can have emotions, you can have sadness, you can have joy. I question whether you can have anger. So that's a question. It seems unnecessary. So you can have those emotions, but it's about not reacting to the emotions that you have as things are occurring. And I think what I took from that was not having an unwise reaction. So you can see things for what they truly are, and then referencing back to the Eightfold Path, you can take action based on wisdom and true insight and understanding of what's actually occurring, because you're not reacting from the emotion that's coming up. If it was disappointment or anger or what have you, you're not reacting from that place. You're allowing that emotion to be what it is, and then taking correct action. So I guess I'll stop there for a minute and ask about the anger piece.
I'm glad you stopped there, because you've covered an awful lot. And what is the word? Is it possible to have anger? And the answer is no. Because anger is a reaction to wanting things to be different. But you can certainly feel sadness. We tend to attach a negative judgment to feelings such as sadness or grief. And that can lead to anger. But when we allow ourselves to just be with what's occurring, use an extreme example, we lost a dear friend. It's entirely appropriate to feel sadness. It's inappropriate to be angry at the circumstances that might have brought that about. So that's two separate things. It seems like a pretty fine distinction at first until you realize that anger is the reaction. Sadness is just a mature response to what's occurring. When you were starting to lay the foundation for what you said, you spoke directly back, and I wonder if you realize this, you spoke directly back to the four foundations of mindfulness: form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications. A fully mature, awakened human being is still engaged in the four foundations of mindfulness, but the feelings and perceptions don't drive a diluted mind state, the fourth foundation of mindfulness, because we understand the process of becoming that fourth foundation of mindfulness that I talk about at the end, or I give the instruction, notice the quality of your mind, remains a mind of equanimity while it's experiencing all of life as life occurs, not insisting that that feelings be different, that even perceptions be different. This is what's occurring. And when you can do that, and it's certainly an easily achievable goal, then life is an ongoing process of peace and happiness, even if we're sad. So one of the things that you might have heard me say a few times is that we can be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. And what that means, when something occurs that naturally drives in the past we might have labeled it as a negative feeling, it's simply just a feeling that a fully mature, fully alive person feels, without the need for it to be any different. So it's a great and profound and fundamental question. No, there's no anger. But we fully integrated the understanding that there's a complete difference between acceptance and approval. So we can suffer the loss of a dear friend. We certainly don't approve of it. But a mature mind allows us to accept it as just part of the process. When the Buddha talked about describing dukkha, the first things he said was sickness, aging, and death are dukkha. It's pointing out that as a consequence of being a human being, this is part of the process of doing that. Life is a death sentence. Accept it. And then we integrate all the other teachings and don't take any of that personally. So you bring up a great point, very profound, and I think we all see how it ties back, or how everything ties together, and you just talked about the four foundations of mindfulness, and those relate through dependent origination to the five clinging aggregates that I'll talk about next week. So you have a few more comments or questions?
I had one more. That is very helpful, so thank you.
Thank you for asking.
Yeah, I feel like I definitely understand that. The other part was around taking things personally. And Danielle and I were talking about this as I was having these insights. And what we try to think of, like, an example. So if somebody, like, how do you, certain things feel like naturally they're being done to, I struggle to say you personally, but
it's directed at you.
This form, yeah. Yep. It's you know, you can't kind of get around it. So if somebody were verbally attacking, coming right at you, then, you know, trying to understand how do you not take that personally because it's coming directly at you. And what I came to was you can have a feeling about that, right? Somebody's coming at you with something. You can be sad about it that that's happening. But then it kind of went back to, that doesn't necessarily mean you have to react to it from that emotional state. And then that comes back to taking action, wise action, where if somebody is to be coming directly at me, I don't have to take that in personally and then react to that emotion in a negative or unskillful way. I can accept that it's happening and then take appropriate reaction. I could ask them to stop, I can leave, whatever the case may be. And I can still, and now from what you said before, I think that helps make it more sense. I can still have that feeling, that sadness about the situation, but because I don't want it to be different than it is, this person is, you know, verbally attacking me, then I can see it for what it is and then either move away from it or recognize where it's, have compassion for them, right, for where that's coming from, and then potentially know what the right thing is to say.
Yeah.
If that's the case.
So, again, you're getting to the heart of the matter. The right thing to say is framed by the Eightfold Path, right speech, right action, right livelihood. We always know the right response. So, someone is attacking you. Where is that need for them to attack you come from? And it comes from a deluded understanding of who they are. And so as we understand our own relationship to the three marks of existence, to impermanence, to the not-self characteristic and the resulting dukkha, we understand how it arises in someone else. And so we realize that there's nothing to take personally. If someone's attacking me, they're acting in a mindless way. They don't know what they're doing. And it's certainly not directed at anything that I am. It's only directed at an image. And if I keep maintaining that image, I'm going to need to continue to defend it. If I'm no longer defending that image in my own mind, people can say whatever they want. I understand where it comes from, and there's no need to react. If it's appropriate to just simply walk away, walk away. If there's some value in, and this is where right speech and right action come in, part of right speech and right action is what I'm saying or doing useful, and is it likely to have the desired result? And so if you think that you can affect someone in a positive way, pointing them towards awakening, then you engage with them. If it's hopeless, you walk away. It's certainly never appropriate to strike back at a person. And then if we do, we understand where that came from. It's a reaction from an ego personality, period. That doesn't forgive the behavior either. And you're really, again, getting to the heart of the matter. What do we do with the outside world? Well, the outside world is the inside world.
Yeah.
And as you reconcile your inside world with the outside world through understanding, there is no reaction. So people can do whatever they want to you. And you don't even get to that point where needing to make that choice. Do I react? You maintain that mind of equanimity. Along the way, you have these realizations, I have a different way to act now. I can react, I can continue to go down that road. Or I can maintain my mindfulness within the framework of the Eightfold Path and maintain my peace, no matter what's occurring. And it's not necessarily an attack from someone else. It could be something that just occurs in the world. A big snowstorm that we'd rather not happen. Well, we can either be all upset about it until spring comes, or we can respond appropriately.
And those things I find much easier to reconcile because I guess I'm not involved necessarily, right, directly.
Yeah.
So the snowstorm comes in, I can't control the weather. It just is what it is. I'll shovel off the snow, and that's fine. And then what has been more challenging to grasp is when it's either something, maybe an action that I've taken that has resulted in a reaction from someone else, or something that could potentially be happening that is more at that core. So one of the examples Danielle was asking was, what about like infidelity, for instance? I mean, that's something that's very much at the core and the personal side of it, right? So how is that not a personal attack? Or is that not a personal thing that's happening? I feel like I understand how it's not, but it's hard to explain.
Well, it's certainly something that would give rise to a reaction. It just would. But that doesn't mean you need the other person to be punished for it in your own mind. You don't need to inflict additional pain. From someone who understands craving and clinging, you can certainly understand how infidelity might arise. If it becomes a pattern in a relationship, then you make a decision. That, you know, it really is that simple. But you don't have to take it personally. Yeah, my spouse or partner happening who happens to have sex with someone other than me, I certainly could take it personal. I can understand where it comes from their point of view. And then you make a decision. Again, it's just another form of dishonesty, which is rooted in ignorance. So we can overreact to it and hold grudges and all, or recognize the impermanence of all situations. And then we make rational decisions too. Is this a relationship that is worth continuing?
Right.
And saying, well, it's not, it doesn't go against the Dhamma in any way. It could, I mean, if it's out of anger. Or it might be just a realization and a recognition of what's occurring.
And I feel like that goes back to taking action taking wise action.
Exactly. And being able to see the situation clearly.
Yeah.
Again, if you're with someone and they have a pattern of infidelity and it's not something that you wish to be involved with, then you make a decision. But it's a dispassionate decision. It's not, I have to leave this and I hate that person forever because of what they made me feel. That's all nonsense. That's all based in delusion. But a rational decision that this is not a person that I wish to continue, we're free to do that.
It's interesting how even things that could potentially be even more impactful in our minds can still be looked at the same way.
Exactly. There's levels of feelings, but everything is included in the three marks of existence. Whatever is occurring to us is impermanent. If it's coming from someone else, it's coming from their not self characteristic. They don't understand why they're doing things, and it results in a generalized dukkha. When the Buddha described the first noble truth, there is dukkha. It wasn't just guess what, there's dukkha happening to you. And it's causing delusion, everybody else is included in that first noble truth. And so when people act in a way that is less than skillful towards us, it's because of that, and we understand it. So we don't need for people to be any different than they are. It's simply what's occurring. A lot of that underlying anger comes from this, an underlying frustration that nobody's acting the way I want them to act. And it builds up, you know, and we do this in very subtle ways. You know, I really don't like the way that person's dressed. I don't like the way that person answered the phone. And an endless list of these things that build up and lead to a tremendous amount of frustration with the world in general, rather than just letting things be as they are. And these little frustrations don't build up because there's nothing there. And there's nothing there for me to attach myself to these things anymore.
And I feel like that occurs too because you want those different things to be like you.
Yeah.
That's where that barrier comes in. And if you can break that down, there's nothing to be like you because you're just existing.
Yeah. How many times do we say, well, I wouldn't do that? Somebody else did.
Yeah.
So. And it really is just, it's deep and profound, but it's just that simple, too. You know?
I was thinking about, you know, when you were saying this, you know, particularly what we would call emotional situations, and it brings me back to, you know, attaching thoughts to feelings, and that sort of just perpetuates that delusional cycle.
Yeah.
Or, you know, how our ignorance organizes itself.
Yeah, and when someone hurts our feelings.
It doesn't feel good, but then to attach something to that, you know, accepting things the way as they are, it happens, but to keep attaching to that and clinging to that, attaching a feeling to a thought, or a thought to a feeling, creates this anger reactionary thing, or
and it continues your mind towards delusion. It's very difficult once you've had that reaction to pull yourself back from it.
Well, it would be said that it could be skillful then to notice the feeling and then towards awakening rather than towards delusion.
Yeah.
Right.
Just I had this feeling. Nobody's responsible for the feelings
Nobody
I had,
did
no
it
matter
to you.
What.
It's just it arose and it was there, and that's how it was. And now we're back here, living the Eightfold Path.
Exactly, and this points back to the deepening concentration that we develop in Shamatha Vipassana meditation within this wider framework. The more well concentrated we are, the less reactive we are, because we're able to maintain mindfulness of what's occurring. So no matter what is coming at us, something came up at, I think it was the first retreat I gave, and it was in this context. Someone brought up the question, well, what happens if a train's coming at you? If a train's coming at you, move out of the way. If a barrage of junk is coming at you from someone, move out of the way. You know, you walk out of the room. Leave them in peace and leave yourself in peace. We don't have to solve other people's. We don't have to solve other people. All we have to do is solve the riddle of ourselves. And that changes everything. It changes the experience, every single experience that we have. No matter what it is, then, we see it clearly. We understand other people's delusion because we've understood ourselves. We understand other people's suffering and reaction to suffering because we understand ourselves. We understand the process. We understand what it means to be an awakened human being because we also understand what it's like to be a deluded, still asleep human being. We've been there. And nobody can have that perspective except each of us discreetly. We have to develop it for ourselves. One of the reasons why modern Buddhism and modern New Age thought doesn't work is that it's presented as a conceptual way. A real Buddhist would just be compassionate. But you can't do that unless you understand how to get to be a real Buddhist. You've got to actually take to the path. You can't engage in concepts of what it's like to be. Of course, we'd all love to be peaceful and happy people. That's what, when the Buddha started his search over 2,500 years ago, he was seeking how to develop true and lasting peace and happiness because he understood the opposite. He looked around him and saw all the unhappiness, all the unsatisfactory experiences that everyone was having, and he couldn't understand it until he got to the heart of the matter, which is the three marks of existence. That was his great insight. And throughout the Pali Canon, when awakening is described by individuals, we'll start with Khandana, it's because they recognize the impermanence of all things, including, and most importantly, this thing called the self. That's the declaration. I see the impermanence in all things. All things that arise, Khandana said, all things that arise are subject to cessation. And the Buddha said, bingo, you got it. You know, you're now Anakandana. You're an awakened one. But understanding that, penetrating that to its deepest level.
And I find that to be interesting too, because going through this and it all kind of falling into place and making sense was one thing. But then last night some things didn't kind of happen how I wanted them to, necessarily, right? All that. And I just had this insight, and yet I still felt this frustration that was just sitting there. And what you had said earlier helped me understand. You can have that emotion, and then but I didn't react to it, so I didn't lash out or get angry or anything like that. So that, I guess, in a way, it helps me feel like there's a level of understanding that is okay, and that ultimately, as you're able to break down that conditioned state of mind that has been something I've been building my entire life, that frustration piece probably will get smaller and smaller.
Yeah, again, that's exactly it. You're developing first an intellectual understanding of the Dhamma, and then if you continue past that, many people stop there. As you continue to allow yourself to actually experience the Dhamma, ehipasiko, come and see for yourself, then you start coming up against that dichotomy between what you know, what you've experienced, and then what you're feeling, that frustration. That's conditioned thinking. And we still have to work through the conditioned response. And that's where the foundational teachings carry us through that. You start gaining the useful insight that this is dukkha. And it's all based on, because of my conditioned thinking, I'm resisting letting go completely.
Right.
I'm afraid of becoming an automaton, and everybody comes up against that. These teachings make sense, but what's gonna happen to me if I let go of everything? Mm-hmm. The best example of that is the man that first did it. He let go of everything and he lived 45 years of the most successful human life possible. He didn't become an automaton. I was talking to somebody about this yesterday too, because they were gaining some insight. It was somebody, an online student that called, and he was almost in tears about his realizations. And what we talked about is the deep meaning that our lives now take, because we're not basing our lives on impermanent nothing. What is occurring in our lives now has deep meaning and purpose. And what's the purpose? The Dalai Lama said it best, I think, even though I don't agree with everything he says. The purpose of time is to awaken. What is more meaningful than to fully mature as a human being? Why else will we be here? It's not to get all the things, all the toys, you know. It's not even to develop a certain measure of comfort in this pot of boiling dukkha. It's to understand what's it's to understand what's occurring. That was pretty good, wasn't it? And if we can understand that, oh please.
No, yeah, I'm gonna wait till you finish.
No, I want to hear what you have to say.
I've been talking like, feeling like I really want to say this, which is making me be like, there's a little ego happening there.
Yeah, let's hear it.
this is something that I have noticed in my experience has helped me in those kinds of situations, because there's a lot here in terms of understanding myself, and I struggle sometimes with the application when I'm dealing with other people, because part of the human condition is that we are all in relationship with each other, and we're constantly confronted with our own ego when we engage with someone else. And how do you, in the moment, practically apply this? And something that has really helped me is that during meditation, if you can identify feelings, thoughts that are ego, then when you're in the moment, you're more likely to recognize those things.
Yeah.
I'm getting, so let me come back to my breath, let me identify that feeling, let me allow this person to do what they're doing, even if it's stirring me up more too. And if I just allow that a little bit, just kind of be with that frustration, and in that moment, letting go of the story, being with the feeling, it just goes better.
Yeah. It just goes better. That's right. It just goes better.
And I have students, constantly. They challenge my ego every 30 seconds. And when I allow my own ego, when I allow that to occur, when I allow this to happen, whatever is uncomfortable here, and maybe even express that to them in a gentle way. I feel like you're attacking me right now, or do you mean to be attacking me? Like something like that.
Right.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize, you know, and then it just goes better.
Right.
Yeah, it just goes better.
So
what you're describing, Jen, is an awakened mind of equanimity. It's a mind that just doesn't react. It's a mind that's fully present in a very meaningful way. In your example, you're able to stay much more present with your students, so you're a better teacher. And that's true in whatever we're doing. You know, whether it's on the job or not, whatever it is that we're doing, playing golf, we're more present. And no matter what we're doing has deep meaning, because we're here.
I noticed that the more you do it, the more you realize how stirred up you get all the time.
Yeah.
You're always having sensations.
Yeah.
You're always having reactions.
And maybe that's because you're actually recognizing that you're having them as opposed to them just happening and you're just completely unaware of the situation too.
Yeah.
But it's good.
It's good.
Yeah.
I remember many, many years ago, I had some resistance to fully committing to the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. Because I just didn't, is this really going to lead to an awakening? And I had this thought that even if it doesn't, even if this is all just a bunch of nonsense made up by some crazy guy, it makes my life better. And of course, that gave me the inner license to fully engage with it, and then I realized the complete effectiveness of it too. There's so much talk now about, and I'm not putting down one person, but I'll use the phrase, the power of now, that we become fixated on, all you have to do is just be present. But there's nothing behind that to develop mindful presence. That's what you could say, that the Eightfold Path is a path to develop mindfulness of the present moment. But most people can't just get there. You can't just say, just be present. Just be in the now. Well, how do you get into the now when you have this conditioned thinking? You have to have a way of dismantling this, and that leads to a little bit to the talk today too, if I ever get to it. So, Anything else?
The only other insight that I think just this conversation has given me another profound insight of just being able to, you can have emotions and reacting or taking wise actions is the right course, and then over time, as you're able to continue to recognize that, those start to really become less and less.
Yeah.
Necessarily. And the action that you take, this is something from more of a personal standpoint, because I had a realization that I want everything to be kind of nice.
I want it to be Mark's way.
Sure. And as you go through that process of something is occurring and you're taking wise action, that action may not always sit well with somebody else, right? Because it may be counter to what they see as themselves as their ego personality. So that was an insight that I had where it doesn't have to be cute and ugly and nice, but it's also not me. It actually can be very healthy.
Yeah.
And for me, that was, like, really huge because I always wanted everything to be nice.
That is huge. I don't want to talk too much more about this, but just using what occurs here in our Sangha as an example. From the time I started, there's always been some individuals that wanted what goes on in this room to be different than it was, to have other kinds of experiences and influences from other teachers and do some rituals. And why don't we do, this is a Buddhist, how come we're not chanting? It was important for me to have, and I remember talking to a few people, to have one place where just the teachings, the original teachings of the Buddha are presented without all the other embellishments that are around today, even though they might be useful and meaningful in some way. It's just not the Dhamma. So let's keep it to this. And so that's not an attack on someone else's desires or beliefs. It's just a preservation of what's here. And we have the almost the duty to do that in our lives too, to maintain the integrity of the Eightfold Path. Sometimes causes us to make some difficult choices. But what's more important?
Yeah.
You bring up some great points this morning.
Thank you for letting me take some time.
Oh, thank you for bringing that up. Again, I the online students that aren't part of a Sangha are listening to these discussions, and there's so many of them now that have commented on how useful these discussions are to them. Somebody said that he's sending me a note, and so when I get it, I'll share it with you. He was just so taken by what he's gotten out of this. So thank you for that. Diane, it's good to see you.
It's good to be here. The one thing it's really been helpful to me to become aware of ego, as was mentioned, and I've come to think of it as a fly in the room. It just buzzes and buzzes and buzzes, and sometimes I can silence it and swat it or something. But just being aware of what is, I mean, and that's what meditation does for me, it continues to help me be aware of conditioned thinking and ego and getting through that. Yesterday I simply put, I engaged in having a refund done to a credit card, and the person was extremely agitated and yelled. I mean, he's a big person and, you know, big, tall and big wide, and when he yelled, it was just, reverberated through me, and I'm thinking, and I felt the buzz of ego come up to, check it all, and after he kind of hammered at me like the third time, he said, "I just don't see why," in a big booming voice, and I said, "I just don't think that way." And I didn't know where, I mean, that was not a premeditated thought, but I felt like that's meditation. That was, I've always wanted dialogue at the right moment, at the right time, and I'm finally finding that through meditation that comes. And one of the other things that I was just going to comment on is I'm changing sometimes the word thought to meaning. So many thoughts I give a meaning to.
Travis, good to see you.
And when I have a consciousness of a thought, there comes this consciousness of what meaning have I given that? How much weight have importance did I take? I mean, when he was talking about taking things personally, I can, you know, if someone stands me up, well, you know, who are they to stand me up? Definitely an ego thing. But, oh, maybe something happened. Maybe they were in an accident. Maybe something even more important than our meeting came up. And that equanimity mind that comes in there to not, in it, you know, take the affront is, oh, it's just a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. The being with what's occurring, even a big burly guy screaming at you, and you can you can still maintain your equanimity.
I would really rather have.
Yeah, but again, you bring up another good point. It's unpleasant.
Right.
Life is dukkha.
Yeah.
And other people are often, are almost always, unless they're awakened, are part of it. We can start looking at our own responsibility. My responsibility as an awakened or an awakening human being is to not contribute to other people's dukkha. The Eightfold Path is the best way to do that. Again, we're I'll get into another subject that I don't need to get into today. But thank you, Donna. Eva, good to see you. How's your study of Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha going?
It's wonderful to be here and wonderful to be with everyone and hear what they all have to say. That's chapter 7, right?
Yeah.
And I felt I liked chapter 7, and I feel as if when my life is going crazy and I'm overreacting and super reactionary, that I have like a life raft that I know I've got everything in there that I need, and I can kind of stop and move away from that and look at it and, okay, well, that's impermanent and that's coming from ego, and so I'm very happy to have that. And then I started into chapter 8 and I got totally confused and a lot of information that just kind of stepped away from that and went back to the raft. But I'm very pleased overall with learning everything that I'm learning.
And you're
being able to apply it.
Yeah, you're able to see how it all integrates.
Mm-hmm.
And so hopefully I'll be able to bring dependent origination into that, you know. But it takes a while. You know, it takes constant application of these things to really understand it. So, good for you. Glad you're here. Don, how about you? How you doing?
Great chapter and great conversation today. Comments in the conversation in the room really helped bring back a lot of what I experienced this week in reading this chapter. With the idea of my ego self in existing within this impermanent and ever changing and universe in flux. You know, just that kind of thinking really, and that kind of knowledge for me in reading this week and then taking it into meditation has really helped me, I think, more understand the importance of concentration and focus and how that is so important in my practice. Like what you said earlier, you said it today earlier, and I thought that was something I really grabbed onto today. Held on to. I need to let that go too. Was that, you know, that idea of developing focus and concentration, and then how that is so big a part of this practice. And for me this week, that concept, whether it's the microcosm, small event in my life, or how that applies to larger things in my life, it applies to everything.
Yeah.
And I really get to see that in action, and it's And just one of many things. I mean, I don't think I can really add to anything anyone said today, but it's great. It's great.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up and emphasizing that point. The reason why we meditate is not to have mystical experiences. It's a very practical tool for developing concentration, which is necessary to develop the rest of the Eightfold Path. We cannot have a distracted mind. When you read about the Buddha's awakening, and of course nobody really knows what happened in his mind, but the descriptions are pretty good. He keeps getting distracted. The stories are written in metaphor, that the malevolent god Mara is doing these things to Buddha while he's trying to meditate. And so what's occurring from Mara seems to be the issue, but what's really the issue is that these things are coming up in the Buddha's mind, not yet the Buddha. He's recognizing them as distraction, and he's coming back to the sensation of breathing. It's not the images that are occurring in his mind. It's the fact that he's recognizing the distraction. He's using meditation to deepen his concentration, and as his concentration deepened, as he was able to maintain mindfulness of what's occurring, then he awakened. Then all the other understandings that he had developed over his lifetime began to make sense. And when he awakened to dependent origination, that I'm going to talk about in a minute. So remember that, keep that in context. This is what the Buddha awakened to. Susan, good to see you.
Nice to see you. I want to echo Eva's thoughts. Chapter 7, I can understand, at least on an academic level, and as I've always said, it starts to permeate as time goes on. Chapter 8, I'm very confused. But I want to express my appreciation to the comments of the class today. It's just been superb, and your comments back really deepen the understanding. I have been having a terrific problem. I had been having a terrific problem getting myself into the concentration mode, even though I was meditating regularly. And I went back to a simple sentence that probably everybody's going to think, oh my gosh, is that really where she is? Very elementary. In your book, that says, when you meditate, you're trying to get out of the world, the outside world.
Again, thank you for bringing that up. Many people use meditation as a time to solve their problems, even if it's on a subconscious level. Well, I'm going to just, whatever comes up, I'm going to think about it, I'll analyze it, where is it coming from? Rather than meditation is simply to deepen that concentration or to go within without any distraction. Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing that up. Patty, it's good to see you.
Chapter 7, although it was intellectually easier, 8, I've been just reading a couple sentences and abandoning it. I think I've read too much today. But even within Chapter 7, impermanence and suffering, those I'm totally in line with. I understand those. But I'm still fighting the not-self concept. It seems like everybody's comments seem to indicate that everybody's sort of bought into that. And I'm very resistant to it still, I find. I want to be combative about it. That's ridiculous. Everything's personal. The whole reality is just how you see the world and how you deal with the world, so everything is. And I recognize that as resistance, because it's so energized. My resistance is so strongly, targeted at the concept that it makes me realize, all right, relax, there's something here. It's, that thing about where change is difficult, and the change of seeing the world differently is so huge that I'm like, okay, so it makes sense to be somewhat resistant to changing the whole way you've dealt with life.
Yeah, that's conditioned thinking.
Yeah, and to be patient, today is great because I was resistant to coming too. I wanted to throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, because it's like, well, if that not self thing doesn't work for me, then what's the point? And I'm not sure if it's chicken or the egg, but my meditation has just been crazy hard at the same time, where I'm just like all over the place, and you know, maybe that's sort of manifestation of my resistance. But so today, being here, I'm super glad I came, because I feel like, all right, if I could just relax a bit and be a little patient with the whole thing, it makes sense. And that if the goal in the end is less suffering, then like, can you just sit with this for a while and let it play out a bit more before you reject it? So, I don't know if that's, I almost feel like I'm further behind everyone else in that I'm still fighting the concept, you know, of whether this whole thing is just a little zany little thing that people do, or if it's, if there's something really here for me.
Well, your courage to continue is remarkable. And you're bringing up the fundamental question that many people go through. Attachment to an ego personality, conditioned thinking, is very, very strong. And it's the one thing that brings up that resistance. I'm not willing to let go of these views that I've created, but that really is the heart of the matter. And to continue, it's just what you're doing, a willingness to continue the examination and the development of this. And then it makes sense. So the Buddha said, anatta, using that word anatta, to mean what you think of yourself is wrong. Let go of it. Easy to, and he understood that too. It's easy to say, but it takes an eightfold path to develop it, and it takes time. You're further along than nearly 100% of the people on this planet, though, because you're moving in that direction. You're maintaining the inclination towards awakening, despite the resistance that comes up to every one of us. And every time that we sit and meditate, when we don't want to, we're diminishing conditioned thinking just a little bit. Every time we bring our mindfulness back to the Eightfold Path, we're diminishing the conditioned response to stay deluded. And it works that way. You know, you chip away at it a little bit. But again, that's where the framework of the Eightfold Path is so important. It's not just meditate. It's not go and sit and meditate and wake up. That's just a simple tool to use to develop concentration. And I'll leave it there. You know, I think that was enough. So thank you for bringing that up. Eva?
I wanted to say about anatta that I had difficulty with it too, and what I finally did was just not even go there. I kind of just let it go. And because I wanted to know, if I'm not that, then what? And
yeah.
I had to create a whole another thing, which just became more work than I wanted to deal with, so I just let it go, and by letting it go, it kind of not solved itself, but just became another thing that I was attaching to that I didn't really need to, and really I do find that I would concentrate on the Four Noble Truths, and especially on the Eightfold Path. That gives me something to do, and then kind of the anatta stuff will sort of solve itself. That's how I kind of feel.
you're absolutely right. The conditioned mind does not relent from a full frontal attack. You need this subtle background that we develop in order to start diminishing the effect of conditioned mind. And then you start having, once you're able to do that just a little bit, start refining your mindfulness, then it starts falling into place. But we have to get past that initial resistance, whatever that might be, however that might manifest. And we do that in all kinds of different ways. That's what has led to the distractions in modern Buddhism. Much of modern Buddhism is presented in a subtle way, but it's a way of continuing further eye-making rather than recognizing anatta, because nobody wants to do it. You know, so we've created all kinds of ways to maintain, I'm going to be a Buddhist practitioner, but I get to maintain an ego personality. Well, it doesn't really work, but it's attractive to a lot of people.
Can I have just something?
Sure.
I don't know. There's an understanding of ego and that the reason we have an ego was to physical survival. We had to have it. And the thing that happens with ego as we mature is it tends to build this humongous I that has to be controlling in the center of everything, and everything has to be the way I want it. But when we start, when another part of our brain starts to develop, it's just a kind of a maturing growth kind of maturing, let's stay with that thing, that okay, I don't have to worry about survival anymore. I don't have to worry about these other things. And ego does not like that. That part of our brain is so, that's the conditioned part of our brain, is so strong, because and if you look at everything that you have a conflict with, it's ego saying you're going to die if you don't have it your way. That's a real interesting thought to go into sometime. But anyway, and that's why the fly in the room is the ego, this huge thing. And there's another part of me that is there. But it's not an ego thing, and it's not anything, but it's there. I don't know whether that, I mean, this some of this is Jung, Carl Jung kind of stuff, the subconscious and the superconscious. But what that helped me with that is I don't need this ego to survive. In the sense that initially at the primate level, I'll stop.
Okay. I'm going to start talking. Is that okay?
Sure. Thank you, Daya.
I want to point out that it was very insightful that you said that you were starting to get worked up and realize that was your ego. Like, that's it.
Yeah.
You know? And so you're doing it. And, you know, I notice for me, one of the ways my ego comes up is ruminating, churning, and tapes that play, and we try to figure this thing out. So what's helped me is if I'm trying to figure something out in my mind, it's a distraction.
Yeah.
It's just, if I'm trying to figure out, you know, even any of this stuff, are you kidding?
Yeah,
I need to figure this out now. That's just more ego.
Ego, yeah. Ego reruns.
Yeah.
Wash them. New season.
And boy, we do that all the time, don't we?
That's a
good way of putting conditioned things. The thoughts that we're so enamored with are thoughts that we've had millions of times before, and we're attached, we cling to them, and we keep running them through. You know, we keep rerunning them. It's like that movie Groundhog Day. You know, our experiences, even though every experience is new because of conditioned mind, we try to make it not new. We try to have the same response. We create sameness from this ego personality when it can't be. You know, nothing. Everything changes. Everything is in flux. We use the word. Everything is impermanent, including, and most importantly, anatta, this ego personality. Next week we're going to get into the five clinging aggregates, and you'll see how dependent origination leads to that, and how, when I get to it today, dependent origination clearly explains this process that we're talking about, developing conditioned mind, in a very direct way. So I want to hear what Travis has to say. Welcome, Travis.
Well,
it's nice to see you again.
Long time, so.
You understand that we're in the middle of, we're actually in the eighth week of this course based on my book, but, you know, how's your practice going? It's good to see
very
you.
Well, very well. I started a new job, and it requires a lot of concentration, and I find that just meditating alone, you know, like helps get the junk out of your head so you can be more focused, you know. Like, you get wrapped up with traffic and your day-to-day routine and stuff, and you can't have that go around your head, you know, when you're trying to concentrate on other things. So just quiet mind and, you know, try to be present in the moment. So, you know, it's been very helpful, even if it's only for a few minutes, you know. It definitely keeps things straight, you know.
Yeah. And it's the foundation for developing full maturity, too. So I'm glad you're here today. That was just a great discussion. So I'm going to...
Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.